Session number 11736, Mr. Stephen Pete, reel 9.
Stephen Pete, reel 9.
As I said, we were flown to Brussels and then spent the night in some, I don't know what it was, some kind of hall, not knowing what's going to happen next. I can't have expected to get back to England the next day, because this is being wise after the event. I've come across a letter written from there describing things. It doesn't... Perhaps I thought we were going to be there for a while. But the next day, I think it was, I was amongst others, and Dennis Westbrook, flown to somewhere in the south of England, and using a kind of wartime expression, but I don't know, Southampton or somewhere like this, to an airfield, where then... we were all questioned to find out who we were, because at Zoom, people were coming by that method in various uniforms and papers and things. And at that point, ceased to be connected with the military and were sent, the two of us, to some civilian distribution point in London with people who had come from the Channel Islands, I think it was. It seemed to be mixed up with. But we seemed to satisfy them with a Red Cross number and so forth, and the next morning we're in FAU headquarters back in Gordon Square saying, here we are. And I was feeling perfectly all right, and Dennis Westbrook was feeling perfectly all right, anxious to get home. We were sent to a doctor to be examined at the Middlesex Hospital, and I was about 8 stone, as a matter of fact, 8.5 stone, I think. I was certainly considerably thinner than when I'd left. And he said, you're pretty all right, need to put on a bit of weight, and you've got 6 weeks' holiday coming up, enjoy it. And I said, but 2 days ago I was about to have my appendix out, I was with a fever. And he said, yes, 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 and treated me like I was... mad. And I thought, this is awful, he doesn't believe me. And so he said, well, don't worry, you know, treating me nicely again. If you get another attack, lots of hospitals in England, you just go to the casualty and tell them. And I went off on holiday and went home. And immediate reactions, I had to wander. I felt very restless, and the fact that I could just go out of the door and go down the road and get on a train. And I went on a wander around England after a little while, and then came back and went back to see the doctor again. And he said, all right, now I'm making an appointment for you to go to hospital and have your appendix out. So he'd believed me all the time and decided I need to get strength up a bit. So that's what happened. I mean, this is getting a bit irrelevant to the story, except I slowly put on weight again, I suppose. And went on kind of half in and half out of the FAU for quite a while, and helped at headquarters with pictures and things for the big book that was being written, and collecting all them and re-editing the film that I'd made in 1941, and all sorts of things like that, until eventually I got my papers.
How many FAU were in your situation of being captured and imprisoned? As a proportion.
Oh, very few. There were the main ones was a group in Greece that didn't get away from Greece, and I think there were 15 or 20. And they were distributed around different camps around Germany. And one or two, or three or four, were repatriated during the war by being protected personnel. One of them died in a camp in, I think, in Silesia.
Was it Harold Cadou?
Harold Cadou is one.
Was he in your camp? He wasn't in your camp.
No. Yeah. It's his brother, Theo Cadou. I was a colleague of, But Harold was at a previous camp, and he was in the prison camp in Germany, as he died some years ago. Mm.
I think he was involved with Dresden, wasn't he?
Was he?
Some of the clearing up, I believe so.
Maybe. Mm. I hadn't heard that. It's actually that the various camps they were in and who they were, they're all listed in Tegla Davis's book. And as I said, I met two of them that came through being repatriated. They came through 4D, so we met them there. What's his name? Somebody, Bill Mile and George Greenwood, those two. And with one of them that I sent letters back, as well as with Major Till, who became quite famous surgeon, particularly skin grafting. I've seen him a few years ago again.
How easy was it to adjust to life, you know, having been in prison for that length of time?
I think it wasn't easy. Although I wasn't aware of it at the time, but looking back, I was very restless. And in fact, and I wanted to get into film work, and I did some almost right away with an ex-FAU man, two, in fact, for a student organisation. And I went, and this was fine, because it helped get over the restlessness. I went travelling around Europe, making three films for international student relief about work that was going on in different European countries, paid for by funds from English students, British students. And that again, maybe that set up even more of a wish, a kind of wanderlust. And I went out, because one of the countries I went to was Czechoslovakia, and I went out there and taught English there, and then I wandered back through Switzerland, about 15 months of travelling. And oddly enough, because his name came up way back, helped Marcus Rumpus make a film in Switzerland. And then back in Paris. So really didn't settle down to what you might call a regular job until 1948. There's a lot of wandering that I needed to get out of my system, perhaps. And I still haven't. But I don't think there's anything to do with prison camp, really. I don't think there's been any. Oh, maybe, yes, I've once or twice wondered whether the ability to sit and do nothing quite contentedly comes from prison camp, where I often did that, sit most comfortably propped up against the wall of somewhere, on the ground, against the wall, reading a book, or just sitting and thinking, without in particular worry. And also the business of sometimes stretching jobs out quite unnecessarily when you've got time to spare. Oh, I don't know, you know, like silly thing like washing up, taking one thing at a time and drying it and putting it in a drawer. That's the kind of thing we used to do, not doing the washing up, but spreading things out so you were active over a period of time, because we weren't by any means working hard doing medical work all the time. But these are rather small things, I think.
When you look back though at your war experience, you know, in toto, yeah, right from the beginning with the work you were doing on the home front, as it were, before abroad, and then your work before you were captured, and even the work you were doing, you know, it would seem you were working very hard in captivity, and, you know, particularly in these very intense periods. You know, what do you think of your sort of war experience? Do you feel that there was something you were able to do in that war situation? Do you feel satisfied?
Oh, that's a very strange question. Satisfied.
Or any sense of sort of satisfaction that you were making some contribution?
Just from time to time whilst doing it, when somebody was particularly appreciative of help you'd given them. Yeah, it's the occasional time within it all, I suppose.
Were you presented with an opportunity, do you think, to serve in a positive way?
Presented with the opportunity, yes. But it might have been far more. And to be dissatisfied with, yeah, for lots of times, dissatisfied with not doing enough. Like standing by with the ambulance train. That is a very soul-destroying thing. But when we found things, useful things to do, which were a bit more than just filling in the time, when we were able to polish the lamps and sweep the floors and all that kind of nonsense. I used to do that rather well. In fact, in the steps of the interior building of the prison camp, I got quite a satisfaction out of keeping the steps up and down to the wards clean, whether I was assigned to the job or just took it. A great big wide broom, and using tea leaves that had been brewed many times and therefore were no use whatsoever for any tea anymore, which are slightly damp. It helps gather the dust together, I still do. Sweeping these very well. Again, probably spending unnecessary length of time because perhaps I could spend 2 hours going from the top to the bottom doing this. That's getting a satisfaction out of an unimportant thing. I did notice, for instance, in times of stress, and one of the most stressful times was before the camp filled up with hundreds of people at the end of the war, and while we could hear the approaching boom of guns and really wondering, you know, from one day to the next what's going to happen, whether the whole place is going to be obliterated in a bombing raid or anything, I began doing very well, using an instruction book, rebinding some of the books in the prison camp library that had got rather overused and badly torn backs and things. And there was a real purposeless thing, but it kept my nerves together. I remember being very conscious at the time, I'm working far better and more carefully than I've done for a long, long, long time. And it was under the stress of imminent disaster. I've once or twice caught myself doing similar things when being under similar stress now. It's quite a useful thing to do, I think. It sort of focuses your mind. But, my own imprisonment was apart from that train journey, an experience I wouldn't like to rehave, was a doddle compared with my father's experiences in Pentonville, I think.
Yes, I was wondering.
I know. He wrote in one letter early on, one of the letters I got, out of his own experience and not knowing what we would be doing, what kind of camp might be in, said get some kind of occupation or invent some kind of occupation, words to this effect, and to prevent yourself becoming a slightly animated vegetable, which was good advice, which I remembered because that was something out of his own experience.
Yes, you were saying earlier about your father, weren't you, and his generation of CEOs, how they sort of opened the way for you. And it's ironic in a way that you, you know, ended your war service in prison as well, like your father.
But a very different sort. I've been back there, oddly enough, to that Annenberg place also, in East Germany it is. I went years ago at a time of a documentary festival in Leipzig, which is about 9.5 car drive away, the other side of the, same side of the Elbe. And It was very strange going back to that village and seeing the camp from the outside. It turned out to be a Russian military camp. Well, this is, I don't know when, 1963, 4, something like that. It was a Russian military barracks, and walked right round it, and inside, it didn't have the barbed wire like before, but just a big wall or fence. There was the one wooden barracks that we'd lived in, the staff of this place was still there, exactly the same. I could see the shape of it. It was rather strange, and then went into some pub or bar or equivalent and met one or two old people who remembered the wartime. But don't really remember that visit particularly. It was just a strange experience being able to go down the road, look in from the outside and drive away again. Leaving that camp in the bottom of the cart, feeling somewhat unwell, was unnerving, going out into the big unknown world. It's a safety inside a prison. You are without responsibility and looked after in that kind of place. I guess this applies to civilian prisons here or anywhere.
Do you think your experience in the war, and particularly in prison, and perhaps, you know, as you've explained, having the time to observe people the way you did, do you think it affected your attitude to your film work? Did it help that in any way, particularly these very fine documentary films you've made for television, Yesterday's Witness, that sort of thing? Is it all one of a piece, do you think, of a piece?
I think it's impossible to tell. You know, if I'd started doing certain kind of things in camp, which I could point to, like for instance, had got very interested in writing or drama or something like that, and had gone on to do something as directly connected, but I don't think any films I've made have been directly connected with prison camp life. The fact that there have been many, or made before that, on social subjects or about refugees or whatever.
To be human.
That's from personal background and interest rather than maybe added to by experience, but I don't see any direct connection. No.
Yes, you've been described, haven't you, as the oral historian of television?
Yes.
Does that please you? You know, do you have particular feelings about oral history?
Oh, it just came along by a kind of series of chances, because I'm really began and maybe still am a maker of films entirely by picture. And for many years, most of the things I made with the picture was the important side. So this is various things happened, like getting work in television and working with reporters and so forth. It was a reaction to working with reporters that and with people talking about their lives. So it took another step into working directly with people and eliminating the reporter or the interviewer, apparently, from the final programme.
Of course, you're at the other end today, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what you think the value of this work that we're doing. You know,
the work that you're doing.
Oral historians, you know, who ask people about their experience. And after all, this is 50 years ago, isn't it? It's going back 45 years ago, 50 years ago.
It's of incalculable value, I think. In other words, it's impossible to calculate how much, because it'll become more and more valuable in 100 years' time rather than immediately, I think. And since it is something new to be able to record like this, although in the past people have done it by shorthand and other methods, that can't pick up the tone of voice or the use of words or dialect or hesitations or anything. So it is something quite different and something quite new. There's such a mass of it, however, now that it isn't really of value unless you have, I think, the recordings and the transcripts. But what worries me a bit is, particularly in the States, the recordings are a means to a transcript, and in oral history research places, if you go to do research, you get handed a transcript, and only about, I think, 1 in 10 or less the people that go for research really want to hear the recordings. I think I remember right at the War Museum years ago when I was doing some research very conveniently with recordings that had already been done, finding some, one case, old soldiers who'd served in India for a program. There was the chance to have both. You had the transcript in your hand and you listened to the voice. That's marvellous. I think that's what's the most valuable.
Yes, the sound is the most important thing with us.
Yeah.
Yes, we don't have transcripts for them all. They're just certain interviews.
But there's a certain very considerable art in transcribing, and not many people can do it well. The kind, I had one marvellous assistant at BBC who, when transcribing, and at great speed too, transcripts and or for that, yes, transcripts of whole interviews which I was going to edit into programmes. And other people wanted to publish the transcript of a program. I found I didn't have to change them at all. Right in the speed of transcribing, she seemed to have managed to get the whole sense and the punctuation right away. I mean, that's a rare ability, because people do ramble on. I know, seeing transcripts of things that I've said, I've been appalled, and most people are when they read transcripts of things that they've said, of just how ungrammatical it reads. There are two kinds of languages, aren't there? Spoken English and written English. James Cameron was marvellous at being able to write both. I know he wrote narrations for various of the Yesterday's Witness programmes I made, or he did used to do rewrite, and things that I'd roughly written. And the very first one we came to record, I questioned a section of it and said, it doesn't make sense. And he said, don't you dare question what I've written. It'll be all right when you just leave it alone. And when he spoke it, it made perfect sense. I learnt then very, very strongly from the master, as it were, the difference of spoken, yes, a transcription of spoken English and prose and written English.
What do you think the disadvantages or the problems of oral history are? And you've already, I think, in your own case this afternoon, you've been once or twice rather worried, haven't you, about telling me events that happened or thoughts, reflections of 50, 40 years ago. So do you think there are dangers with it if you're looking for truth, historical accuracy?
Yes, if you're... what is historical accuracy? of course there are dangers if that's what people think they're going to find from oral history. Oral history is what people believe they remember, and they can believe it until they're black in the face. And we came across various instances, particularly when people are remembering something that's happened in a troublesome or a hectic time, and they will tell you exactly what happened. I mean, this has been tried out all sorts of ways, hasn't it? Like people giving descriptions to the police of something they've seen, and they're all different, and they all know
they're telling the truth. But that is what oral history is, what people appear to remember. And if, when we're recording, they get a date wrong, this is unimportant. It's the spirit of the memory of what happened. Of course things get coloured with time. I'm sure you've been amazed of things that you think you remember, and you even find you haven't even been there. That can be from old family albums of yourself as a child. I've got a memory of rolling down a hill with lots of other children, and only recently I found I would have been minus two at the time. It's my memory of seeing the photograph of other children in the family doing this and that kind of thing. But that's not an untruth, that's a memory.
So your Italian officer in the plumed uniform, that would be valid?
I remember him, or I think I remember him. That, or the kind of feeling of the surprise of seeing some Italian officers in uniform waiting, I'm about to say, waiting at attention, you see, I've invented that. But the feeling that they were there ceremoniously to greet the ship with British military on. If I've put plumed hats on their heads, I'm adding to the feeling of the ceremonial occasion. And maybe that's not very important. Maybe they did.
Lecture, don't you, on interviewing techniques and
in different
oral history?
Yeah, in different kinds of ways. I've got copies of a lot of the Yesterday's Witness programmes, and also some material of the uncut film as was shot, uncut rushes in film terms, so that I can, for instance, show interviews as they took place. They're ones that I made myself, with the person being interviewed answering questions that I'm asking from underneath the camera, because the technique we used was to apparently have the people who told their stories addressing the audience directly. And so we sat underneath the camera very close, and the eye line looks as though it's towards the audience, towards the camera. And so one of the things I'm able to show with this material is the way we undertook the interviews, the things that went wrong, how sometimes we interrupted, unfortunately, because what we wanted was just the story told without any voice coming in or overlapping a word, how we were able to edit a long and rambling story into something a bit more pithy, but without destroying the meaning, because that's a responsible job to do, is to edit a story and not change it too radically. In fact, have the cream of the story. All sorts of things. So that for those students or filmmakers or academics or whoever, including oral historians who are interested in spreading out and using video, able to show not how to do it, because there's 200 ways of doing it, but I try and remember to say it's how I used to do it, and because I thought this was the best way. If you want to follow this way, that's up to you.
Mm-hmm. You let your people speak in their own way and at their own pace.
Well, help them, in effect. It's helping them retell the stories that we know that they know. And we don't go in with the camera rolling. It isn't instant television or current affairs television, investigative television, where you've got somebody with a microphone in your hand. And it's very much the reverse. It's getting to know people well, so that when you return with a film crew or whatever method you're using, you're coming back with some friends, as what I used to say, who are all going to be interested in your story. And the person whose stories you want to record, want to make them feel prima donnas, comfortable, always went to their homes, so that they knew where the loo was, and then neighbour came in maybe with coffee, and they sat in their favourite armchair and felt comfortable. All this kind of human side to it, which is very important. And I think the results showed, usually, that the people were speaking freely and easily because of the care. Yeah, just use that word, because of the care we took, care of them as well.
I think trust is another word you use, is it not?
Mutual trust, that we weren't going to betray the trust by misusing their stories, and so we had to trust each other, yes. That's what I wish I'd put on the end of the